So then in the end, we've got this kind of this group of progeny sired by high resilience boars and this other group of progeny sired by low resilience boars. And then repeated the same approach for the last study where we experimentally inoculated pigs with highly pathogenic PRRS and then just evaluated how did they respond to that challenge. And then from that, we saw that indeed that group of high resilience pigs had fewer mortalities than the low resilience group. So actually half as many mortalities in the high resilience group during the first 3 weeks pulse PRRS challenge, which is the most critical time frame following PRRS exposure.
The Swinet Podcast Show Canada is only possible with the support and trust of innovative companies like
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. When it comes to 25-hydroxy D3 products, purity matters. Hy-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Learn more at hy-d.info. Top Pigs Norsvin, the world's most innovative swine genetics company.
Welcome, everyone, to a new episode of the Swinet Canada podcast show brought to you by Wisenetics. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the Canadian pork industry. So my name is Miranda Smith, and I'll be the host for today's episode. And with me today, I have Dr. Janelle Dunkelberger, who is a geneticist at Topics Norsvin based in Minnesota in the U.S. So welcome to the show, Janelle.
Thank you, Miranda. Appreciate that. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about like breeding pigs for enhanced disease resilience. But before we get into that, can you first give a little bit of an introduction to your background and your current role with Topics?
Sure. Yep. I've been with Topics Norsvin now for 9 years. And prior to that, I was a grad student, actually. So came right from academia into industry. Started with Topics Norsvin and then have been with the organization actually ever since. So I did my graduate studies at Iowa State University in genetics. And actually the focus of my PhD was looking at the role of the host genome in response to disease in pigs, namely viral disease. So I actually continue working on that subject quite a bit still in my current role at Topics Norsvin as a geneticist, but then also responsible for our global health and behavior research platform.
Okay, so what kind of research do you do then?
Yeah, really the main objective of the work that I do in that capacity is looking at opportunities to breed pigs for better health and, say, better behavior. Those are the two kind of main categories. So essentially looking for new ways to define health and behavior, because that's kind of a question in and of itself. What does it mean to have good health status or good behavior? So a lot of kind of investigation in terms of what traits do we want to focus on in terms of breeding pigs for desirable health and behavior traits? What type of data do we need to collect to do that? Assessing the genetic basis of those traits and really just looking at opportunities for how we can collect information on an ongoing basis with the goal of improving those types of traits.
Okay. And so when we're talking about like disease resilience, can you explain a little bit like what that really means?
Yep. Good question. Well, really, disease resilience just refers to the ability of an animal to maintain performance in the face of a disease challenge or to be able to quickly recover in their performance following a disease challenge. But maybe one thing to point out there is that sometimes I hear the words resilience and resistance being used kind of interchangeably. But actually, that's not really correct because they really do refer to two distinct type of things. I think often when people are talking about resistance, the implication is that that animal won't get sick, that they're completely resistant to infection. But that's not necessarily what resilience means. Resilience is more of an umbrella term where a resilient animal could have enhanced resistance to a disease or to a pathogen, or they could just simply be better at responding to whatever type of disease pressure that they might be encountering. Mm-hmm. And I think that, for a lot of people maybe that are listening, they've experienced or witnessed or have some kind of connection to resilience in the field. If you've been in a barn in a disease outbreak where, on the one hand, you might see a pig that, despite being exposed, especially in the midst of a known challenge, that animal doesn't know that it's sick. They continue to thrive and grow, and they don't have clinical signs of disease. So we'd call that a resilient pig. And on the other extreme, you might see these pigs that they just can't handle it, right? They can't cope with the challenge. They've got severe clinical signs that fall behind. And in the worst case, they actually become a mortality event. And then you can also see pigs that are anywhere in between. So really kind of the two extremes, but any other type of animals in between. So kind of a range of different responses and resilience that you might observe.
Mm-hmm. And so like how much of that difference is due to genetics, would you say?
That's one of the big questions that I was actually tasked with when I first started with the organization, is to try and get some kind of an understanding of what is the role of the host genome in response to disease or resilience more specifically. So actually, the journey to investigating that for me and in my role within Topics Nourishment really started actually with some feedback that we were getting from customers in the field at the time that I started, where there's one terminal line in our genetic portfolio, for instance, that customers were coming to us and noting a kind of an intrinsic resilience advantage of this line and started asking questions about that. So we were getting this anecdotal information that these pigs that were sired by this particular terminal line were demonstrating enhanced resilience in the face of a disease challenge. But it was all anecdotal at this point. So one of my responsibilities then was to think about how do we design some research trials where we can actually investigate that and quantify a potential resilience advantage if that does exist. So in the end, we ended up designing a trial versus another competitor line. So we had pigs sired by our terminal line versus pigs sired by a competitor line in a side-by-side evaluation. And we did everything that we could to try and control for all of the other potential environmental influences that can come up and impact, performance of animals in a trial just in general, but also including how animals were exposed to disease. Because that's a big one when it comes to getting data from the field. Because one of the big questions that we always have to kind of think about is this concept of exposure. Because in a field setting, there's always this question of, was this animal, did it perform better because it's actually more resilient, or because they just weren't properly or thoroughly exposed to the disease? So that's a hard question to answer with field data. So what we did is we actually experimentally individually inoculated each pig with the same infectious dose of highly pathogenic PRRS strain circulating in North America at that time. And then we evaluated their response to disease. We collected all kinds of data at the individual level, including kind of pre and post inoculation. And then from that, what we saw was that we were able to confirm our hypothesis that there was indeed significant differences between these two groups of pigs in terms of their mortality, but also performance under challenge. So that gave us kind of the answer to that question that we were looking to address in terms of whether there is a between line of variation response to disease. And often that's a good indicator that a trait might have a genetic basis. If you see these breed differences or line differences for a given trait, right? It gives you enough evidence to then ask the next question, which to us is actually the more relevant one from an animal breeding perspective, which is, what about the within line variation? So that was the next question. Say, okay, so we see that we have evidence of this between line variation in response to disease. but what about the within line variation? So we had also collected very detailed information, including genetic information just on our group of pigs that were sired by this terminal line that I mentioned in question. And from that, we dug deeper into trying to explore what does the phenotypic variation look like in response to disease among those pigs, and then also the genetic variation. So what was really interesting is we saw that, you know, even within a given pen of animals in this study, where the pigs were all the same age at the time that they were inoculated, exposed to the same pathogen, same way, same dose, came from the same sow farm, same feed, same management, all the things. And still we saw this tremendous variation even within the line, right, where there were some pigs that, just for sake of example, 1 month post-exposure, they didn't know that they were sick. They kept growing, kept thriving. But we know that they were exposed. We're confident that they were exposed because they were inoculated. And then other pigs that had died soon post-infection. Like, okay, what's going on here? Is there a genetic reason for this difference in responses that we're seeing? So actually the first step that we then took was just looking at plotting the percent progeny losses by the sire used to produce those progeny. And from there, we saw that there were some sires that had really high percent progeny losses, like 35, 40% of their progeny died during the course of the study. So we'd call that an example of non-resilience. And then on the other hand, there were a couple of other sires that only lost 3, 2, or even 0% of their progeny.
Wow.
Okay, that's an interesting finding. So that kind of being what we would call some kind of practical evidence of genetic variation in response to disease or resilience. And then the next step was we conducted an actual formal genetic evaluation where we combined all the phenotypic and the genotypic data and actually estimated heritability of traits like mortality under challenge. And there we saw that, yep, mortality, for instance, is a lowly to moderately heritable trait in that study. So confirming also that hypothesis that not only do we see the evidence of between line variation, but that within line variation also quite clearly existed.
So that means that you can specifically breed for disease resilience then, right?
Yes. Yep. Yep. So one of the next steps that we took kind of following up on that study was absolutely prompted this idea of, okay, this is a good indication that we can use traditional breeding just to facilitate genetic selection for improved natural resilience to disease. So then the next kind of logical step or course of action was to see, can we show that in an experimental setting? So what we did is the follow-up study that we conducted, we wanted to investigate this idea of actually using the data that I just described, collected from that initial study, as a training population to predict breeding values for boars to use in this follow-up study. So by that, I mean just using that data set that we had collected to estimate genetic merit of boars for disease resilience based on their genomic information. This is the same process that we use to estimate genetic merit for any trait of interest, except the crucial differentiating factor in this example is we only had one trial worth of data off of which to base these predictions, not this, you know, continuous flow of data that we're typically collecting on an ongoing basis for other traits. So we did that exercise. We estimated breeding values for boars for disease resilience, all boars at a single stud in the US, and then just rank those boars, you know, based on their breeding value for disease resilience from top to bottom. Picked the top ranking boars and the bottom ranking boars. Said, okay, those are going to be our groups of sires that we're going to use to produce progeny for the study. So then in the end, we've got this kind of this group of progeny sired by high resilience boars and this other group of progeny sired by low resilience boars. And then repeated the same approach for the last study, where we experimentally inoculated pigs with highly pathogenic PRRS and then just evaluated how did they respond to that challenge. And then from that, we saw that indeed that group of high resilience pigs had fewer mortalities than the low resilience group. So actually half as many mortalities in the high resilience group during the first 3 weeks post-PRRS challenge, which is the most critical time frame following PRRS exposure. So from that, we were really encouraged. We said, okay, that helped us move from this concept of, okay, the theory that we should be able to facilitate genetic improvement through disease resilience because of all the genetic variation and the heritability that appears to be there, but then actually being able to demonstrate this in that validation study. We've collected a number of other kind of validation studies or follow-up studies since that initial validation by tweaking different parts of the study. So we've looked at kind of modifying the experimental design in different ways, using different genetic lines, different isolates of PRRS in combination with other co-infections, et cetera, and have been consistently able to show that we're able to predict resilience of progeny based on selecting sires for their predicted genetic merit for disease resilience.
Very nice. So basically, like, you used standard breeding practices to come to a pig that is, well, not resistant, but resilient when it gets a PRRS infection. So that's really interesting. And it's kind of cool to that it all started from a line that was even not, like, it wasn't bred for that specifically, but it just happened to be there. So do you know, like, genetically, like, why, like, what part of the genome is causing this resilience?
Our hypothesis going into this was that we likely wouldn't detect like a single major gene associated with disease response, because traits like disease resilience or resilience to heat stress or resilience to something else, they're what we call a complex trait. Not just because they're complicated, which obviously they are, but complex for the reason that they are due to lots of different genes with small effects on the trait of interest, not due to the effects of single genes. So our anticipation was that when we dig deeper into trying to understand the genetic architecture of these traits, that we would likely detect lots of different regions involved. And that's what we've seen, is that, you know, consistently from these different trials that we run, regardless of the resilience trait that we evaluate, regardless of the genetic background of the animals placed on test, that time and again, that's what we see is there isn't really a huge major single gene that's explaining all of the genetic variation in response to disease, but it's the combined effect, you know, of all of these different regions across the genome that together are responsible for resilience. And that's why traditional breeding makes a lot of sense for a trait like disease resilience, is because with traditional breeding, you know, the end goal is that you estimate breeding values for that trait, or that estimated breeding value captures the combined effect of all of these different regions. So it's a nice way that we can actually take advantage of all of that naturally occurring variation across the genome.
But of course, when it comes to the standard breeding practices, like, you're not just looking at one thing. Like, you're focusing on a lot of different things, right? Like, for years we were looking at like bigger litters and then like more growth. And so are you now focusing more on disease resilience in your breeding practices, or is it only like one small part of a whole slew of other things that you're selecting for?
Yeah, good question. And you're right. We intentionally try to make sure that we are paying attention to numerous different traits simultaneously. We refer to that as a balanced breeding approach. It's more effective and a better longer-term strategy from a breeding standpoint if we are taking all of these different traits that impact different biological processes into account together Because if you don't, if you place too much selection pressure on only a couple individual traits, you could have unintended negative correlated response to selection. And so with respect to disease resilience, addressing your question about how we're approaching that now, we have very recently made the decision to actually implement traits associated with disease resilience into our overall selection index, but with a modest weighting at this point. And that's because in coming months, we'll actually reveal some information about another strategy where customers will be able to capitalize on that even more. But at this point, yeah, that pipeline is complete. Those traits are constructed and the index now inclusive of those traits so that customers will be able to take advantage of that.
Okay. And do you foresee using gene editing in the future for like similar traits like this?
Yeah, also a very relevant question because it's timely discussion with regard to approval of gene editing applications in the US and Canada and all of that. Yeah, so first and foremost, just as an organization, we're definitely not negative to the technology at all. And in fact, we use gene editing within our research group, but in a lab-based setting. We see it as a valuable tool for helping to address research-related questions such as understanding gene function and associations of particular genes with certain traits. It's a very useful tool in that sense. But we have made a decision as an organization at this point in time that we're not going to use gene editing as a tool in our commercial breeding program. At least in this point in time, we don't see a need to pursue that option just because all the potential target traits that we would apply gene editing to, we see evidence of natural genetic variation in those traits. So kind of coming back to bringing this or connecting this to disease resilience, as described a little bit earlier in our conversation, we already see a lot of evidence of just naturally occurring genetic variation in disease resilience. So from that perspective, we already have a tremendous opportunity that we can take in terms of just taking advantage of all those natural mutations that are already within the population and applying traditional breeding strategies to enhance resilience in that way. So in that sense, we don't have to navigate the use of new technology or potential unknowns regarding new mutations. We can simply take advantage of a variation that already exists.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, so what would you say are like the key takeaways from your research like on this subject?
Yeah, first and foremost, it's just that we have a lot of opportunity to improve disease resilience in a natural way, just using traditional breeding strategies, which, to be clear, is the same approach or same methodology that we already use to improve every other trait in our breeding goal. And kind of as mentioned a little bit earlier, regardless of the changes that we've made to the different trials that we've conducted, whether it's the age at which pigs are inoculated, the co-infection model, the isolate of PRRS, the genetic line, we consistently see that resilience is a lowly to moderately heritable trait. So that indicates great potential just for improving it using traditional breeding strategies. And then secondly, I talked a lot about PRRS because PRRS is probably still the top pathogen on our mind just from a perspective of a global pig breeding company, because it's still probably the most relevant pathogen in global swine production. So it makes a lot of sense that the data that we're collecting is inclusive of response to PRRS, but the data that we're collecting is not limited to PRRS either.
I was actually just wondering that, like, if they're resilient to PRRS, doesn't mean they're also resilient to like PED or any other viral or even bacterial infections, or are those like different pathways?
Yep. Yep. Very relevant question. So the data that we're collecting, it's not just under PRRS exposure, but in these different batches, there's on a number of occasions, pigs come from the sow farm flu positive. They might also have some strep and E. coli. Then they get challenged with PRRS. You also see all kinds of other stuff popping up later. You know, PED's been in there, mycoplasma, salmonella, you know, all the things that you would typically see in a real world type of production environment. So in that sense, the data that we're collecting is not just representative of how the animal responds to PRRS specifically, or even a specific PRRS isolate, but is really representative of just overall disease resilience. So their ability to respond to, you know, all of these different types of pathogen challenges, bacterial, viral, in combination, et cetera.
And I don't know if you know the answer to this one, but like if you go with a gene editing approach, would that be the same? Like if you remove this part of the gene so that they're not resistant to PRRS, for example, do you know if that also then makes them resistant to other diseases or not?
To answer that, I'm going to refer back to something that we talked about earlier in our discussion, which was, I forget exactly how you phrased it, but the question was related to what's the genetic basis of disease resilience, or what did you learn about the genes that are related with resilience? And there I responded that we see that it's a polygenic effect, or it's a complex trait, lots of different regions with combined effects on the trait of interest. So that's the answer. There's a lot of different genes that are involved in resilience. And so, yeah, it's not feasible, or it's not possible to, the phrase is multiplex, multiplex edits for all of these different genes in a single animal simultaneously that would really be impacting the trait. So there, you know, the application of gene editing at this point in time is really focused on traits that are controlled by single genes. All right. And maybe in the future, we'll get lucky and be able to multiplex edits in a couple of different genes. But every time that you introduce an edit, you reduce the efficiency and the probability of ending up with an animal that is fully edited at all of those different locations that you intended to introduce the edit. Right. So in that sense, the best way that you can capture, you know, the variation influenced by all of the different genes that really are involved in resilience is by estimating breeding values that simultaneously capturing those effects. But no, it's the application of gene editing for disease resilience at best is going to be limited to these specific instances where those effects are controlled by single genes.
Okay, thanks for clarifying that for me. So is there anything else that you would like to share with the audience today before we move on to our final three questions?
I think that... Yeah, I think it's been a good discussion. I think that pretty well sums it up for my side. Yeah, thank you.
It's time for our famous three.
WiseNetics turns podcast airtime into brand authority. We don't sell ads, we elevate voices. If you're ready to boost your authority in the industry, access WiseNetics.com and speak with a brand authority specialist. Let's transform expertise into influence. Starting now.
So to our listeners, if you're enjoying this episode of the Swinet Canada podcast show presented by WiseNetics, please remember to like, subscribe, and share it with your colleagues, friends, and family. So now we're going to the final three questions. So the first one is, what is your favorite swine-related book or resource?
I've been thinking about this one since you reminded me of this question. Maybe kind of two different categories of things. One is I love to see what's going on in the industry. So I always look forward to kind of getting my National Hog Farmer update every day, or also kind of, or articles in Pork Magazine. That's another favorite one that I like to reference to keep up on what's going on. But from more of an academic perspective, I was trying to think about, like, is there a textbook that I reference often? But honestly, probably just my class notes from grad school, my animal breeding courses. I have a professor from grad school specifically who is notorious for very detailed notes, and still have those saved on my computer. And yeah, that's definitely a good resource for going back for more of those technical questions.
Nice. Okay, so what about a favorite book or resource outside of agriculture?
Yeah, that's a tough one because there's so many good resources. The one that came to mind, probably just because it was one that I read most recently, was this book called The Culture Code. That's a book that I read for a course that I'm currently taking, and I really enjoyed that. It was all about, well, it's really written from a perspective of leadership, right? And talking about examples of different leadership strategies. And I really enjoyed that. I think it had a lot of good kind of real world examples, lots of illustrations from sports and things like that of how coaches motivate their teams, which I found really interesting.
Okay, interesting. Yes, I will have to look that one up. And then the last question is, in your opinion, what sets successful swine professionals apart from those that are not?
Yeah, from a leadership perspective, my answer is going to sound cliche, but I'm going to say it because I really believe in it, which is just listening and communication in general. So often I think that situations can be avoided if there's just better communication, whether it's a technical issue or a misalignment in understanding of goals or people frustrations or whatever. It seems like so many of those things actually can be avoided just with good communication. So I always appreciate that, especially from my leaders or managers, people that really take the time to listen, listening well, and not just hearing what you're saying, but trying to understand why you're saying it and what motivates you, and kind of all of the things that go with that.
Yes, it's definitely a very important one. And I think we hear that quite a lot, which goes to show that it's kind of a universal thing that people like. So, yeah. Well, so thank you so much for joining me today on the Swine in Canada podcast show.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, so that concludes another episode of the Swine in Canada podcast show presented by Wisenetics. So don't forget to subscribe to the podcast to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please leave us a review. So thanks everyone for listening, and until next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.